Welcome to Tech Talk.
By
CDT.
Back in 2018, CDT's own Mallory Nodal teamed up with Nielsteen Uver from the Critical Infrastructure Lab at the University of Amsterdam to present a draft document at the Internet Standards Governing Body called the Internet Engineering Task Force, or IETF. This draft outlined a proposal that urged the community to officially reject the use of discriminatory and exclusive language in internet drafts and RFCs. As we persistently uncover and confront systematic racial inequalities across society, it becomes equally vital to guarantee that the fundamental design comprising one of our most critical and democratic technologies, the internet, is devoid of any historically racist or prejudiced terms. Here to explain why we must reject the use of discriminatory and exclusive language, our CDT non-resident fellow and assistant professor of AI and European democracies at the University of Amsterdam, Nielsteen Uver, and CDT's chief technologist, Mallory Nodal. Niels and Mallory, welcome to the show. We're so glad to have you here.
It's such a pleasure to be here, Jamal. Thanks so much.
Hey, yeah, nice to be here too.
To kick us off, can you give us a bit of a refresher for our audience on what the IETF is or the Internet Standards Governing Bodies generally are?
Sure, I'd be more than happy to. So to understand what internet governance is, we need to go a bit back, namely to 1865. That is when the International Telegraph Union was established. And that body, which is the oldest still functioning international organization, actually governs all the communication channels that we have in the world, telephone, satellite, spectrum, except for the internet. So during the Cold War, the United States started developing this network that could withstand a nuclear strike, which then developed together with other networks into the internet that we know today. And part of that, for the development of the protocols, there was first this informal body, the Internet Engineering Task Force, that in the early 90s, when the internet was privatized after the fall of the Soviet Union, became the official body for the setting of voluntary standards for the internet. And that is the Internet Engineering Task Force. It's a body where everyone can participate. You only need to have an email address, and you can participate in different working groups that set the protocols, which are kind of the rules of the road for the internet, that allow for interoperation on this network of networks.
Taking the next step, because we talked about kind of the rules, and I'm curious to hear about this concept of inclusive language. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
For sure. So language is the way we think and construct. So in part, the way that we use language provides categories in which we think of the world. So also our worldview is reflected in the language that we use. So we shape language, but language also shapes us. And it really shows power imbalances and forms of inclusion, exclusion, and remnants of power structures that exist in the world. So language is one way of thinking and interrogating what are the power and opportunities that are at play in society.
Anything to add there, Mallory?
Yeah, I think it's important to note why this is coming up now on why we're talking about inclusive language the way we do in the work Niels and I have done in the IETF, but also in the larger tech space, and then obviously the mainstream conversation about topics like diversity, equity, and inclusion. And so this inclusive language idea is that in order to improve diversity and equity, we have to first be inclusive. They're all kind of intertwined, but we're really focused on this last piece in the technical community because for the most part, it is very much out of reach. It is monoculture. And that has effects on who participates and how robustly they participate. And so it's one of those attempts to solve it. I would say that in the larger scheme of things and all the tactics that we need to use in order to get to a more equitable society, this is, you know, a subtask of a sub-tactic. It's so far down the list of priorities and how impactful it is, but it's just in this moment or in the moment we were in 2018 all the way till now, still These small changes actually do matter. And so when folks talk about inclusive naming or inclusive language, they're just trying to erase these, what were previously like invisible barriers. It was just metaphors that we used on a daily basis, like, you know, the metaphor of master-slave for timekeeping atomic clocks or for different kinds of servers and internet architecture. You know, now we aren't using them. And it's because that before seemed like a term of art. But then when folks started questioning it, it really doesn't have any good reason to exist. And because it did feel exclusionary, and we want to center actually how people feel, I think that's an important point. They were bringing this in. It isn't just the cold, hard logic of language. It's more than that. Then it hopefully is just, even if it's just a gesture of a community or institution to start using different terminology, that gesture actually goes a long way. But I think it's even deeper than that. It isn't just a gesture. Like Neil said, it's changing the way we think. Questioning the metaphors we use can be really transformative. And so I think that there's a practical side of why we want more inclusive language, but then there's also like a real political and in community kind of outcome of this too. So that's sort of why we talk about it.
And I cannot do anything more than agree with Mallory. And perhaps I can add a couple of examples to illustrate this a bit, because maybe for some people who are not intimately working on internet protocols and standards, this might seem a bit opaque, but as we'll later talk about, for a lot of people working in internet standards and protocol, it was also a bit opaque. But I want to go back to the artist engineer Ramzi Nasser, who developed the Arabic programming language KALP. And when he developed that, he called it a piece of engineering performance art. And I was very surprised when he told me that, because I asked him, why don't you just call this engineering? Well, then he said, because every layer of the stack is going to reject the Arabic script. And I was really shocked by that, because my experiences on the internet and before that on bulletin board systems and on Usenet, for the internet felt really free. But that was because the internet and bulletin boards before that were built for people like me and people who use the Latin script and people who have a pretty good command of English. But if your native tongue is not English and if it's not a Latin script, then you continuously feel that you're not welcome on the internet. And then you do not experience that freedom, but a sense of exclusion. And this sense of exclusion is also repeated in the governance culture, because while the door is open, there are still significant thresholds for people to participate, as Corinne Kath showed in her excellent work, Loud Men Talking Loudly, which was also the basis of her PhD thesis, in which she did ethnographic research in the engineering task, Internet Engineering Task Force, showing that there are many barriers for participation, even though the Internet Engineering Task Force use openness to legitimize its organization. And a final example is also the use of militarist language in a lot of these communication networks. And that is not a coincidence, because traditionally transnational communication networks are tools of power and control to project power outside of territorial borders. So if we want to undo that and use the internet as a fundament for our information societies, then we should build this public internet interest internet infrastructure based on public values, and that should be reflected in its language as well. And that's the work in part that Mallory and I have been doing.
I'm curious to know, how did these exclusionary terms make their way into internet drafts and RFCs, and why can't they just easily be removed?
Well, I think it goes back to, Neil started way back when he talked about standards, which I think is actually a pretty appropriate place to start. But then you get to see that, you know, we're talking about communities that started in the 1800s. We're talking about like the International Telecommunication Union. So that's one thing. They're old communities, and science, as we know, has had a really direct, not indirect at all, relationship to racism. We can think of eugenics and other kinds of practices. Those aren't computer related, but they are becoming popularized and made more rigorous around the same time. there's also another era where this starts happening. So when we were doing research for the document we wrote that sort of traces the history a bit of these terms, there's someone named Ron Eaglash, who's a scholar on this topic. In one of his papers, he talks about the atomic clocks, which for a long time was the classic example of the use of master-slave as technical term of art. It's not offensive, was the argument. And when he looked at that use case, in fact, it had been standardized, or it had been in use, the use of atomic clocks had been in use and using other terminology. It wasn't until the 50s and 60s that master-slave became adopted as the term of art across the industry. And, you know, if that were in the U.S., which I can't remember exactly, but my guess is it was, there were a lot of civil rights upheavals during that time that may indicate that that was an intentional shift, or at least not benign, right? We can, I think he makes the connection in his paper that someone used those terms on purpose. It is a choice. And you ask the right question, I think one that a lot of us have been asking through this process, why can't we just change them? Why can't we, as the deciders, make the decision? And I would say that there, in many cases, and to the IETF's credit, the deprecation of the use of blacklist, whitelist, and master-slave in the context of the domain name system terminology specification happened actually pretty immediately and without much fanfare, which is proof that that can just be done. The other argument, though, that folks made was, well, standards are very integrated in the sense that, you know, if we're going to develop a standard in this community, we are also citing a standard on the hardware layer that's written by the IEEE, and we don't have control over how the IEEE calls it. And so we have to use the terms they use because, you know, the different ways our standards interact require that. But that's also eroding because, and we'll talk about this more later, this has been across the industry change. So at this point, we are, you know, really close to completely eradicating some of these terms. And it just takes time, but eventually we all kind of get there. So that argument isn't nearly as strong as it used to be. And I think we can just make the change. It doesn't always happen immediately, but it's certainly possible.
Yeah, and to what Mallory said, it is kind of prototypical for the standards community that they want standards language that they don't want to change because that's the standard, right? So, but then this community also has the opportunity to set a new standard. So with great power also comes great responsibility. And there are also already examples of things that we call different on different layer. What we on the data link layer, what we call frames, we call on the network layer packets, and on the transport layer we call it segments. Right. So it's also a term of convention that can change as times change, language changes, and so there has been in philosophy this long trend of a long discussion about what's the role of language. And sometimes engineers think quite naively that there is that language is a direct representation of reality, but it doesn't. It drifts and it shifts and it adds order. And that's why it's important that to come with the better insights that we get, we create better language so we can actually do better science and do better engineering with more and smarter people in our communities that help diversify who we are and how we think, because that helps us get better outcome, because heterogeneous communities produce better knowledge than homogeneous communities.
What have you all done to change this in the IETF?
Well, in 2000, I think that must have been 18. Yeah, October 2018, Mallory and I got together and we saw some excellent, we were reading Fanon and we were discussing it and looking at discussions in the Python community where there was a discussion about inclusive and exclusive language, and we saw changes in the field. So we thought, wow, why don't we also bring this change to the IETF? So that actually we can have a level playing field. We do our part, and we help promulgate this thing. So we sat down and we wrote what is called an internet draft, which is a draft document that when it's accepted by the IETF and its surrounding communities becomes an RFC, also known as request for comment. But if you start commenting once it's called an RFC, you're too late. So we published this draft, which was called Terminology, Power, and Oppressive Language. And we discussed about alternative language for master-slave, alternative language for blacklist and whitelist, added some examples, and thought, well, this should not be too hard. This should probably be a relatively easy thing to go forward with. But that was not what we expected.
So the draft actually does three things. It sort of makes an argument for why this is important, does a bit of a literature review based on some of the things Niels and I have been reading, as he said. It outlines very specifically two term pairs. We don't try to list or include every single kind of offensive term. We just focus on master-slave and blacklist, whitelist. And we describe why they're a problem and we suggest replacements. And then the last thing it does is it puts in context for the IETF a way to operationalize how to fix this, right? So we speak directly to the RFC editor in the draft and suggest some ways forward for how to migrate from better terms and away from ones that are offensive. And I think just to timeline this, it's been 5 years now. You're right, Niels. It started with you sending a link about the change happening in Python. So the Python community, which is a programming language, said, we're not going to use master-slave anymore. And you sent that link without a lot of context, actually, to the IETF at IETF list, which is the whole community. It's got thousands and thousands of engineers on it. And the list just exploded. So there were it was not a pretty one. I laugh now, but it's just a trauma response. There were so many folks who replied, and many, if not almost all of them, were very aggravated by the suggestion that we need to change our scientific and very neutral terminology because of feelings. And I think we engaged as best we could at that time. And there was just a very long thread and many different posts. And I feel like the draft was an exercise in pulling together all those arguments that were happening in different pieces of the thread into one complete place. So you could follow the arguments, right? It's like we were on one side, we were just working on all these different fronts, right? Saying, well, people's feelings do matter. And then on the other one saying, and atomic clocks weren't even using that terminology until the 50s. We were doing argumentation at every layer, and it felt really all over the place. And so that document really helped us organize our thoughts and come up with a cogent argument for why these terms need to be replaced, and then operationally how we need to do that. And then I think the next important thing, so in the timeline then comes, the draft just sits there for basically 2 years, but then George Floyd was murdered by police and the United States exploded in rage, and it really kicked up this discussion again, not in the IETF, but in the larger tech community. People were talking about inclusive language in tech and elsewhere, and just the race conversation in the US was so robust, and it gave us an opportunity to re-up this draft that had been sitting there nascent for a year and a half. And more and more sort of controversy ensued, but we did get a lot more attention to this draft. It was the focus of a lot of people's attention and time, not just us this time, but like many of the leadership gave us space on the main agenda to present it, to talk about it, to improve it. And then another thing that was great is the chair, the IETF chair at the time, who's a CDT alum, Alyssa Cooper, she just made it happen. She just created a document that listed all the term pairs that the RFC editor was to make sure were never used, documented that, and it just happened. We just don't use these terms anymore. And I just really, want to appreciate the leadership for just making those changes. I think they at some point also made some statements from the leadership perspective, like in support of this. And so that was really another great milestone. And really since then, the document is still an internet draft today. It was never RFC'd. We've made some attempts to get that document to become an official standard of the IETF. It might not have ever made community consensus, which is what would be required for it to be considered an informational document from the IETF, but we've also tried other kinds of publishing streams where it would just be like an individual opinion of the two authors. That also hasn't worked because folks feel it's too controversial. So I don't know. It might just have to live on the internet forever as an internet draft. What do you think, Niels? Do you think there's hope for us to get it RFC'd someday?
Yeah, I really appreciate you telling this history because it has been a very intense time. And the barrages of thousands and literally thousands of emails were really intense. And a part of the episode that we just kind of skipped over is the posting of several counter-internet drafts that try to ridicule this work with some outright very racist language that were actually removed by IETF leadership, which is very seldomly happens, from the archive of internet drafts. And that's very seldomly happens. So I think it really shows how this community that's very organized in a very bottom-up manner here really was ripping at its seams and leadership felt it needed to come in. And I think that the document isn't becoming an RFC is showing that there is no community consensus. And that is scary. That is really scary to see also because these are the people that produce the technology on which our information societies run. On the other hand, it's also very nice to see that this community apparently is able to select its leaders to do the right thing here. So I think it's a bit of a mixed bag. And I think this is what happens with many human rights, right? We will never attain human rights. Human rights is not a position, but it's a goal. It's a strife. It's where we're going for. But human rights are like muscles, right? If you don't use them, you lose them. So it's continuously trying to gain them in our writing, trying to undo the systemic injustices that we also reproduce ourselves in the language, in our position in society that we're in, and trying to create a better world. And this process was part of that, and we learned in it, but it also wasn't easy. So yeah, so there are currently now, I looked it up, 14 official versions of this document, and maybe 14 is where it will stay, and maybe later we will get also better insights and better ideas on how to approach this. Because it was never our idea or our intention to shame people. We thought like we're going to try to make technology better, right? And apparently we also haven't found the language to bring people along in this process. And we keep on fighting to do it better, to make the language better, to make the institutions more open, and to make the technologies to produce a more human rights enabling environment across the world.
I think we talked a little bit about the backlash, but I want to hear what are some of your big successes and the positive effects. I know we touched on them a little bit, but I want to see if we can go a little deeper.
So there is one element of backlash we haven't totally touched on, and I think it's important to note, which is that this exercise, and I think that is kind of a good way of putting it, like, you know, what our intentions were and what actually happened, you know, it's neither here nor there, but has really dusted up a lot of these issues, right? And that has been hard for Niels and me. I know it was really hard for leadership at the time, but it's also been really hard, obviously, for the people who feel excluded in this community that, yeah, maybe they had some awareness that it's not the most inclusive space. It's pretty homogenous, very white, Western, male. But this whole argument and it being so volatile and so protracted, I think has had an effect on inclusivity in a negative way, because now it's been a little bit more exposed and out in the open. And so there has been some damage to having the conversation. It hasn't been a full, like, toxic cleanse so far. I think there's still, and people in this, you know, evidenced by the fact that our ID isn't going to be RFC'd anytime soon, is there's still some tenderness around that. I really want to care and center the people who still feel excluded. I think we need to think about how this draft or other initiatives are either helping or hurting that. And that's where we should be thinking about. And less so on, you know, overall health of the community, because I think it is a resilient community. We need to worry about the folks that are most marginalized.
Yeah, and I cannot agree more with Mallory. And we also cannot have a healthy community if we do not have more people involved. And that is because the community of the IETF produces an infrastructure that is used all across the world. So we're entangled with these communities that are currently not represented in the people that set the standards. So that's what we should strive for, and that's what we should work for. And uncomfortable conversations are definitely part of that. And I think that's part of the work that Mallory and I and many other great civil society advocates are doing and have been doing since 2015, 2016, where we've been participating in the IETF and trying to mainstream public interest topics and societal impact of standards, protocols, and the internet architecture, and try to front that in the design process and try to make the internet a better place by front-loading these societal considerations to ask, what do we want the internet to do for the world? So that we don't need to shape the world after the internet, but we can shape the internet after the world we want and so direly need.
So to go to your really, the best part of your question, Jamal, about the positive things that have come out of it. So the IETF is not alone in this. There have been a lot of different parts of the community that have addressed inclusive language, and it's been great for me to try to be as involved in those other efforts as possible to sort of compare how it's gone in the IETF versus elsewhere, to create some solidarity between the folks trying to make changes elsewhere. And so that's been wonderful. So some of the places where this is changing, and we are in overall a much better position than we were in 2020, like hugely changed. So one was almost right away, and this is actually what kind of sparked our draft to get re-upped the summer of 2020, was the Inclusive Naming Initiative was founded. They're like a sub-grant or a subgroup of the Linux Foundation, but they're tech-wide. And they really are developing this super comprehensive language guidance that includes everything from like sexist terminology to ableist terminology, military terms, like Niels mentioned, all of them. They're trying to be as thorough as possible. And that group has been great. And, you know, they cite our draft, and I've been involved in their work from the beginning. Another great win was NIST, and this is a US standards body, NIST cited our draft in their guidance about eradicating these terms. So that was very affirming. And by extension or as a result, the official adopted guidance that the IETF does have for this cites the NIST document that cites our document. So in a way, you know, we've sort of had an impact on the IETF directly. So zooming up to today, I know that the IEEE, this is the Institute for Electrical and Electronics Engineers, they do a lot of hardware stuff. They're known for the Wi-Fi standard. Two things are happening there pretty imminently. One is that the last vestiges of the use of master-slave, which was timekeeping in internet-connected clocks in the Wi-Fi standard, has been removed. And that has been balloted. And I believe that ballot closes very soon. And I don't see any indication that it wouldn't pass. And so it will now, the excuse that we cannot eradicate it because it's still in use in some existing standards, that argument will disappear. So that's a really big win. And then the second one is that the IEEE's standard association at large, from the very tip top of the organization, stood up a working group to create language guidelines for all IEEE standards. And it is like the Inclusive Naming Initiative. It's everything in the kitchen sink. Every single possible offensive term is being in there, and that has been balloted. It's not necessarily passed, but there have been comments. So we're working on integrating those comments with another group of folks in that group, and so eventually the SA will adopt that document, and that'll be a really big win too. And then lastly, in the last actually call we had on this IEEE document, I heard that ISO, the International Standards Organization, is also going to be adopting a top-level language guidance document. So at this point, I feel like we've made collectively across the tech industry pretty big strides on this language piece. And I just want to say it's a relief to be able to move on from this, because I think I said earlier on, it's like this feels like the smallest possible change. And we have much bigger things to do in terms of improving diversity, equity, and inclusion. It's like, it'll be great to kind of feel like this work has achieved its goals and we can move on to other tactics now.
Again, I think you touched on it, but I just want to hear just a little bit more about where the work is now in the IETF.
So where we are now in the IETF is that when you write a document, it is automatically being checked in a process whether you're using any of the known existing exclusionary language, and then you're asked to change it or to at least consider using different language. And then subsequently, in IESG, in reviews of the document, if it gets past the working group stage, people will also look at it and ask you, could you change this language? And via that way, via community discussion, the language will get filtered out, and we haven't seen use of that language since. So practically, it has been significantly addressed. But as said, language changes, right? So we need to be vigilant and keep on interrogating and understanding our role in society and our roles in reproducing systems of exclusion, inclusion, because we are not aware of many things, right? And we cannot be, and that's why we need other people. So in a sense, we have worked on a thing, but that is just one step to just keep on getting better. But there is also no end to those steps. But it's been great that we have done one step and we're working on many different fronts, and we'll continue. And some of the things can and will be addressed in the IETF and others not so much. But that's no reason to not keep on working on them, because the IETF is an institution with real power and with real influence. So that's also the reason why we are there and why we also stick around and do the work.
To wrap us up, just any final thoughts from either of you?
So among your audience, you probably have really great engineers, tech-minded people, but also people who have very deep thoughts about technology. You are, and even policy experts, or maybe especially policy experts. We really hope that you can help us think us through the interrelations and the complexities of the interrelation between protocol and systems development and human rights and policy implications. And if you want to think about that and engage with the people who actually concretely built that, the Human Rights Protocol Considerations Research Group, or HRPC, is a very good landing place to do that, discuss that with us, to hear talks. If you look at the on YouTube, there are a lot of great past talks of the years that we've been doing this. We're also working on documents with which we try to analyze internet protocols. So a new document is about to be published on that Gur Shabbat Grover and I edited, and that has been shepherded by Mallory. And in that document, we try to analyze internet protocols, and we always need people to do analysis of new protocols to see and understand how they change. And in the past, we've seen that this methodology has impacted changes in the standard setting process. So we need people to help us think through this, because this is not a solved research question. It's not that compliance between human rights and the internet infrastructure has been achieved, because the translation of these socio-technical and social-legal concepts are not done, especially since both the understanding of human rights and the understanding of technology progresses very quickly. So if you're interested in it, come join us, else follow the work, but also you're very welcome, of course, to do your work where you're doing it. And that's the only way we can form a broad movement that works on social justice on all sides of society.
Yeah, great pitch, Niels. I think HRPC is a really good place for this. I think there's still, just to manage expectations, I think that while we're really happy with all of these different technical communities making these positive changes, there's still actually a long way to go. And it's a long game, though. Like you were saying earlier, these are exercises. We're strengthening muscles. We need more people to have more impact, and it's not going to happen right away, but we're laying foundations so that we can do this sustainably and over the long term, because that's the kind of change that's needed if we want the internet to remain for people. Because I think, yeah, there is this counter trend or counter force that is really difficult to come up against, which is just massive consolidation and corporatization of these spaces. It does a lot of times just feel so robotic and like we're surrounded by automatons, and it's hard sometimes to break past that like real dedication to sort of logic and neutrality and things like that when the stakes are really high in the ways that these technologies have real world impacts on people. So yeah, let's move on and keep moving on.
Yeah. And if you feel like you want to study this more or think about this, the initiative that I'm mostly involved in now is called the Critical Infrastructure Lab. And the Critical Infrastructure Lab has two biweekly reading groups on alternating weeks. So every week you can discuss books and read them together. The one focuses on the interrelation between infrastructure, rights, and freedoms. And the other one is focusing on the interrelation between infrastructure and the environment. So if you're interested in that, go to the Critical Infrastructure Lab website, criticalinfralab.net, and look up the details. You don't need to register. You can just join. And you can also find the PDFs to the books there and just discuss them with us.
Great. Well, Niels and Mallory, it's been a pleasure having you. Thank you both so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for making the space, Jamal, and for inviting us.
Of course. And for all our listeners, to keep up with the work of CDT's policy teams, please visit us at cdt.org and follow us on Facebook, Mastodon, LinkedIn, and the social media platform formerly known as Twitter at CynDemTech. I'm Jamal Magdi, and thank you all for talking tech.
Happy hacking.